Good evening and welcome to another fantastic episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom, where we examine the art and science of games. We have a great cast for you tonight. I'm going to be talking to the founders behind Toys for Bob, as well as the creators of Star Control 1 and Star Control 2. Star Control 2 being one of my personal all-time favorite games, and they're here to talk about the development of that game, as well as, by the time you're listening to this cast, the announcement of Ghosts of the Precursors, which is going to be a direct sequel to Star Control 2. So, please welcome to the cast tonight, Paul Ritchie and Fred Ford.
Hi there.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, Paul and Fred, it is a pleasure and a real honor to have you both on the cast tonight. How are you guys doing today?
We're doing well. We're up in Northern California, which is, unfortunately is suffering from many wildfires, but we're safe right now.
That's good to hear. And hopefully that fire doesn't spread while we're talking, because we're going to try to keep this within an hour, but who knows what happens. I don't want you guys to get in any kind of danger while we're chatting.
Oh, well, we're prioritizing this.
Great.
So we will absolutely remain in position.
Awesome. That's good to hear. So, like I said, it is definitely a huge honor to have you both on the podcast. I know for those of you listening, Paul and I think I sent you an email, it was like 2015, 2014, about, hey, would you like to come on? And then I think we kind of like lost track. And then I saw the announcement like a week or so ago. I was like, didn't I send Paul an email about something like that like 3 years ago? And that's how this got started again.
Yeah, persistence really pays off, particularly with me. You know, things can happen years later. So I recommend that if I haven't responded to an email, usually 3 years is a good time to get back.
Good. If it's 2 years, is that considered too soon?
Depends, you know. If it's really exciting, sure, that's fine. But like 1 year, holy cow. No, no way.
Great. All right, there is certainly a lot to talk about. And I know we have just about an hour to speak, but it's a good thing we have a limit, because I think I probably have like a few hours of questions regarding just like Star Control 2 alone. But we're going to try and hit all of our points today, and worst comes to worst, maybe we can have you guys back on in another, I guess, 3-4 years from right now.
Okay.
So,
don't press your luck.
So, I guess to get the ball rolling, for some of my newer or younger fans listening to the podcast, could you guys kind of go over like your backgrounds and, you know, like what is Star Control for someone who hasn't heard of the series?
Sure. Fred and I are remarkably young people who have been in the industry longer than almost anybody. Fred and I started making games separately in 1981, 1982. I was working with a company called Epix, at that time it was called Automated Simulations, working on fantasy adventure games, the Keys of Acheron, and later a game called Archon for Electronic Arts, as well as a few others.
And Fred? I was working at a place called Unison World, which turned into MagicSoft, doing games for initially handheld Japanese, like half calculator, half computer, and then transitioning onto Japanese personal computers.
And without knowing each other at the time, we were both attending UC Berkeley and making games and attending school, although Fred was more successful at that than I was.
Meaning that I finished.
games were so fun to make. Stay in school, kids. That's what I'd say. That's what I told my kids. And they did a better job than I did at remaining in college. But so starting in the early 1980s, we each began making computer games at the time. So I did Archon with John Freeman and Anne Westfall, as well as the sequel, Archon 2, Adept. Mail Order Monsters with Evan and Nikki Robinson, World Tour Golf with Evan and Nikki Robinson. And
my games were sold exclusively in Japan, so they never actually were sold in the United States.
And so then in 1988, I was looking for a different publisher, and some friends had moved on to Accolade, and so I was able to sign a three-game contract with them. And game number one was Star Control. And so I had a little problem, which is I had no programmer to help me make it.
And I had gone out of games when I graduated college, I thought I needed to get a real job, and I worked in the Silicon Valley for a little while and then came up to Marin County and was working at a graphics company and found myself saying, what am I doing? This is not as fun as making games. And luckily, where I worked, a couple of childhood friends of Paul's were working, and so they put us in contact with each other.
And we met, I think, playing games at a guy named Greg Johnson's house. He was the designer and sort of the key storyteller for Starflight and the designer of a ton of other amazing games and kids' train rap albums.
Is that the same Greg Johnson who did Toe Jam and Earl by any chance?
Absolutely.
Oh, I actually spoke to him, I think it was last year, just before he did during his Kickstarter for the revival of Toe Jam and Earl.
Yeah, he is one of the great lights of game design over the past 30 years. I think he's going to keep doing that. Mm-hmm. He's also probably listening to this, and he may or may not have a weapon trained on him.
But yeah, it's definitely interesting about... It's kind of funny, like, talking to, like, developers who's been around for so long, because everyone starts to know each other. Like, I spoke to Sandy Peterson, like, a few months ago, who, of course, originally worked on Age of Empires, and now he's doing his own board games.
Yeah, he was back in role-playing game days, I believe. Mm-hmm. I think I knew him. Was he Champions? Or I'm trying to remember what his... Was he paper role-playing games before that? I'm trying to remember if I've got that right.
I don't know for sure. I didn't even realize he worked on Age of Empires until he like brought it up during our first podcast.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah, it's actually a really great career. So that's why we've all stuck with it. the alternatives don't look so great. You know, you have to like be serious and show up wearing like a collared shirt. So we really like making games. We're going to keep doing it.
Awesome. That's good to hear. I don't want you guys to quit after this podcast. I'm sure all my friends will come after me saying you're the one who made them quit. Get them. So for people listening to the cast, what is kind of like the pitch or the main gameplay of the Star Control series?
Sure. Fred, step in whenever you want. But if you remember a game called Space War, it was maybe the first video game. It was created on very old computers in the 1960s when they were brand new computers. And it featured two spaceships fighting each other, sometimes around a gravity well, a star in the middle of the screen. And that game became eventually an arcade game, Space Wars. It ultimately became games, the foundation of games like Asteroids or Space Wars or Space Duel. And it's just been a style of game that we've loved forever and ever. So we built a rich PvP combat system, although I don't think we called it PvP back then, but players blowing up other players with cool spaceships, different powers, different alien appearances, and very asymmetric combat.
Yeah, we didn't try to balance the ships. there was very rock, paper, scissors sort of relationship.
We did balance the teams by giving them costs so people could sort of customize the teams that they had. And everybody, you had to play with controls that people might consider odd now if they aren't already Star Control fans, which is inertial controls from Asteroids, if you've ever played that, which is rotate left, rotate right, thrust forward, fire your main weapon, and fire your secondary weapon or special power. And that control set is extremely flexible and powerful. It's hard to learn if you haven't already. So we have a lot of people who play Star Control with controllers or with controller-style commands, and they seem to love that. But it was really based upon a hybrid of action and in the first Star Controls game, three-dimensional strategy. So that idea of hybridizing thinking and fighting has been fundamental to most all of our games.
It's kind of been the bane and and fun part of our careers, because people love to categorize things and they have a hard time categorizing what we do.
Yeah, it is very interesting about Star Control. It reminds me a lot of the original XCOM and how it was built on very different systems of design, all kind of like stitched together to create something unique. And when it comes to Star Control 2, One of like the big parts, of course, is how nonlinear, basically just how wide that game space was. I guess, what was the, decision or the philosophy behind just basically giving the player like the entire universe to explore in the Star Control series?
Sure. So Star Control 1 was a hybrid strategy action game. Star Control 2 was quite different. It was a hybrid science fiction action adventure with the same sort of expanded Space Force style space combat. And I remember in our pitch document, we wrote, this is going to be a big but not epic scale game. And that was a straight up lie. Immediately we said, okay, how can we possibly support hundreds of stars and thousands of planets so that people can have an experience that, Fred and I both grew up watching the original Star Trek. And that was what I wanted my life to be like. So, because I couldn't hop around and explore alien worlds on my own, that's what we wanted to replicate. This idea that, there's places to go and things to do that are important. But if you just want to take a left-hand turn and start exploring planets and picking up strange alien creatures, do it. It's up to you. You're the hero. You get to decide.
And we did take a kind of big departure from adventure or role-playing games of the time where, in most of them, if you did something wrong, you died immediately. And that just wasn't very fun. And we didn't ever want you to really be wrong. You could do things, you could fight against the stream, but you should always be able to succeed with what the choices you make, even if it's harder.
Mm-hmm. And you correctly time XCOM. XCOM and Ron Gilbert's adventure storytelling games were all sort of coming out at the same time. Mm-hmm. And Ron was a big fan of not killing the player. And, we love Monkey Island. And so you can see influences flowing back and forth. Flowing from those other games to Star Control. And same thing with Starflight. Greg Johnson, a friend of ours, had made a game called Starflight 1 and Starflight 2 along with Binary Systems, some other great guys there. And we played that, and that inspired us. We wanted to make our own science fiction adventures, and we actually ended up getting a lot of Greg Johnson's help in making Star Control 2.
Mm. And as you said, Paul, a lot of the major inspiration was kind of like the Star Trek, explore the universe, run into all kinds of crazy aliens and get into trouble or try to get them to help you out. I guess what kind of inspirations did you guys take for the various factions of Star Control?
Well, everybody sort of has a different way of looking at it. Mine is that I have various characters speaking to each other in my heads at all times, which some people could see a detriment, but I found a way to turn it into a positive. So over the years of making Star Control, we really focused on the space combat. So we had the ship designs and an awful lot about the physical mechanics of the aliens, and then their personalities and their desires and their needs I would just sort of talk with them in my head. Now we knew that in the first game, we set up that there was an alien invader, the Urquan, who sort of shows up in our vicinity of the galaxy, very, very powerful with this collection of battle thralls, which are other alien races that have been compelled to fight for it. And fortunately, there are some good guy aliens who want to fight them off, and they need our help. They need humans' help. And so it's this battle between the Urquan hierarchy and the Alliance of Free Stars. Now, we did this first game. We could kind of say anything because there really wasn't a story mode behind it. But coming along with the sequel, we had to explain. So why would aliens with all of this, mechanical capability and resources and power, why would they do this? This is a really energy consumptive practice and kind of dangerous. And so we spent a long time crafting what we thought were interesting deep rationales, whether it was functional, like they had to do this. Someone blew up their home world, so they had to find a new world. Or if it was sort of more psychological, which is they had gone through some trauma in their past, and that had sort of forever changed the lens, the way they viewed the world, and they were absolutely dedicated to making sure that never happened again, which then to everybody else looks like evil invaders. Or goofy sort of cultural reasons, a race that's based on cowardice and surviving all of the hostile ills that the world is constantly throwing at you, which is the Spathy, which is pretty much a direct reflection of how I see the universe.
We'd also be remiss if we didn't mention that we were inspired by many science fiction writers. We're both avid science fiction fans, and the stories that we read influenced a lot how the aliens turned out.
Yeah, I mean, so much so that as you probably know, Josh, we listed in the back of the manual all of the favorite authors and favorite mm-hmm. books, I believe, at least favorite authors. And there are references, constant Easter eggs throughout the game to those stories and those authors.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess with the writing the various factions, I guess, do you guys have any ones you're particularly fond of or your favorites?
Gosh,
always a fun, you know,
like,
picking your
like
baby.
Asking, yeah, who's your favorite child, your son or your daughter? Gosh, I shouldn't say this, but I do like the Illrath, and they're just pegged to evil.
yeah, I think probably for me, the Zakfot pick.
Oh yeah,
there's writing that dialogue was so fun. And the personalities of the characters I had a lot of empathy for. And Fred just posted a fan picture of one of the aliens is this sort of obnoxious, talkative character, again, maybe more like me, who is absolutely fascinated with this sport called Frenzy. And, you know, it's great that people like sports, but sometimes you run into people you just want to throttle because that's all they'll talk about. And in the fan picture Fred posted yesterday, someone had given it a vuvuzela from, and he was blowing it constantly. And one of the other, I guess the Zoc was saying, "This means war, Captain."
Nice. Getting back to the design of Star Control 2, I guess one thing I just want to clarify, when it comes to the actual like universe of that game, that was all like hand done, right? There wasn't like any like random elements to the actual like universe development or like the game space.
No, Paul defined the location of the star systems, mm-hmm. and then all of the planets were generated procedurally, mm-hmm. except for specific ones like the Earth, which obviously looked like Earth. but yeah, there was no way we could have done that game with effectively two people, mm-hmm. although we had a lot of help writing, without some procedural mm-hmm. help.
And we would go in and, you know, so for example, the planet generation is kind of interesting and unique. And we were able to take the routines that Fred had written to generate sort of fractured terrains or cratered terrains and then color them to build very character rich planets. So when we first started looking at it, and I was trying to approach it with my giant encyclopedia of science and technology and think up ways of like, what are the composition of the worlds in terms of elements and how do those turn into chemicals and how do those volatilize into the atmosphere and how does the size and color of the sun then hit the atmosphere and everything turned into Venus in every simulation. And I'm a horrible programmer and a not great mathematician, so this was the wrong approach. So that was a month out of my life I probably shouldn't have spent on it. But then we went and said, you know what's cool? Like an acid world. You know, a place that's green and blue and it just there's this fantasy of pools of acid and with lightning storms. All of a sudden, it's like, oh yeah, that's how science fiction works. Find something interesting and talk about it and make sure that it somehow fits within the realm of believability.
Mm-hmm. Because as a quick tangent, one thing that I find very fascinating about talking to developers who create games during like the 80s and 90s was the fact that a lot of these older games made use of elements like procedural generation. The same when I talked with Greg Johnson about Toe Jam and Earl, I was kind of surprised to hear that game was really another one of the very first games to make use of that kind of procedural generation for level design. Because you normally, or at least for a lot of gamers, they don't associate procedural generation until later on when the roguelike genre started to become really popular over the last decade.
Yeah, but those games predated mm-hmm. everything we did. They existed way back on just ASCII teletypes, early video systems. But, you know, like the text adventures, they sort of came and went, but they had established such an essential backdrop of what you could do. And, you know, it required people to imagine a lot. It's like listening to radio versus watching TV, you know, looking at an ASCII display of a room and imagining that it's a dungeon. So when we started getting cool graphics, we could still go back, though, and rely on some of the fundamental fun that those people had created.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it wasn't that the procedural generation defined what we were going to do with Star Control. It was quite the opposite, where we had these expansive desires, and kind of for self-protection almost, we had to figure out clever ways to do it, because we didn't have hundreds of people to help us create everything.
And, you know, that actually plays into one of the reasons why Fred and I are working on Ghosts of the Precursors, which is we had to be exceptionally clever with our resources, whether it was memory or time or
music,
hands on mice. We didn't have a lot of what we have been able to get access to as the years have gone on. And it's great to have a staff of, you know, 150 brilliant people who are better at you in every way, and then just sort of organize and lead those people to make things. But there comes a time when you're like, gee, I haven't actually drawn anything or written anything. And that's what really started building up sort of this passion for Fred and I for going back and trying to craft the same, I won't say challenge, but the same experience of needing to be clever with resources, needing to be clever about how we approach solving our problems so that we can't just throw dozens of people and millions of dollars at every problem.
And because even as Paul mentioned, we are still quite young, there comes a time in your career where the horizon is approaching.
Another question that I have for you guys regarding the design of Star Control 2. As you said, you definitely expand on things between going from Star Control 1 to the second one. And one game design mode that I thought was very interesting was, of course, landing on the various planets. And, of course, being able to explore, gather resources, and stuff like that. You mentioned a few minutes ago, of course, the acid planet with lightning and fire. I always love landing on those planets because I remember when I was young, I couldn't understand what the actual numbers or the stats for the planets were. So it was always that fun surprise of landing, and then you get hit by 10 earthquakes, 5 lightning bolts, and fire just around. I'm like, oh God, let me get out of here. And at some point, I was like, you know what? I don't care anymore. I'm just going to run and see how many resources I can grab before things blow up. So what was the inspiration behind planetary exploration for Star Control 2?
Well, some of it was a lot of games these days, they hold your hand, and you don't really experience the journey from being relatively powerless to being powerful and appreciating how you got to be powerful. And so we really wanted to start you out weak. And so that exploring a planet was an adventure for a while until you dealt with the Melnorm and got the upgrades and, you know, upgraded your ship. And so we really wanted you to appreciate the journey that you made from relatively weak to pretty much indestructible.
It is early on, though, there is a recurrent lesson I have to learn, and that is make it simple, make it fun, and let the player do it. I can't tell you how many times I have gone down this road.
I can.
No, Fred, no. So early on, what we thought of was, wouldn't it be cool to drop out of, you know, hyperspace into, you know, the Oort cloud or, you know, the outer limits of a solar system and launch away teams, send this ship of, you know, Spathy and Ilrath over here and they'll mine this world and these guys over here will attack that ship. And we spent a long time actually building this system where you would build up away teams and, you know, and ultimately it wasn't fun. Mm-hmm. And so it's okay.
The ratio of bookkeeping to fun was high.
So it was instead of assembling this team and thinking through their numbers, what if you just fly down yourself and drive this thing around and avoid earthquakes? And I was like, oh yeah, that's what they do in Star Trek and Lost in Space and in all of the science fiction books I love. They don't sit back and get other people to do the exciting things. They jump right in the middle of it. And so that was one of the important lessons, which is, oh yeah, I want to go down there. And we created this you know, the idea that your hit points were the number of crew you had, and that, yes, you could get blown up, but pretty early on, you're really sending out, like, landers down to planets, have a fixed number of people, and when they're exhausted, your lander explodes. But you can get more landers. So you're running through crew like chiclets, but you are always the last one on your ship, you personally. And so you had this sort of succession of failure states before you really lost. And you could almost always compensate for bad decisions. And there were some really good decisions too, like some of the speed run people you see playing games now. They play Star Control 2 as well. And they, if you watch how they play, I mean, they rocket through the game at 20 times the speed we thought it would be because they just make the right decisions.
Yeah, it's always fascinating to see, like, the speedrunner culture build up around some of these games. I was watching someone did, like, Final Fantasy VII in, like, 8 hours. I'm like, how the heck did that just happen? Well, how does someone just beat that 80-hour game in 8 hours kind of thing?
It's actually a really interesting phenomenon. Mm-hmm. You know, optimization and excellence is... people are passionate about it in sports and in esports. Mm-hmm. And the people who you are interested in watching usually have skills and reflexes that you just are outside your capability for most people. And so for me, watching them, there's some people who do it based upon, you know, a succession of learning bugs or tricks or something like that. But for a lot of people, it's just not making any errors at all. And there's something attractive. It's like watching a dance or something. I just find it really compelling to watch people who have achieved that level of mastery.
Mm-hmm. There's a lesson that we've learned over and over again over the years too, which is let people play the way they want as much as possible. So don't design the game to force people to play a particular way, because that isn't the way that everybody wants to play it.
Yeah.
And I was going to just say the Toys to Life genre, what we created with Toys for Bob and Skylanders, was one of the strongest lessons in that, because early on we had visions of doing what we normally do for balancing a game, which is controlling frustration and controlling performance. And then what we realized is, well, there are no rules about toys you can have. Like, we don't say, you may have a, you know, G.I. Joe and you may have these three Hot Wheels. That's it. And so what we had to do is kind of step back and say, we need to make this fun, giving the player a tremendous amount of freedom in how many characters they have and how often they switch. And that was really interesting. And we had to trust players wouldn't make this experience unfun for themselves. And they're actually, you really can rely on players to find the fun in what you're doing. And ideally, you offer them a lot of different venues for that. And you mentioned that the Star Control universe is wide open. We worked very hard to give that illusion, but in a design sense, it's built in some very specific chapters. Mm-hmm. And if you stray outside of those, you can stray outside of those chapters, but you run into a semi-permeable membrane of death very rapidly, where, you know, just either there's, usually you hit something that's going to take you out. And if you're really, really skilled, you can actually push through it. But there are very specific, you know, they're in the sort of on paper pencil diagram we have of the game. There's sort of three or four things that you need to accomplish, and that effectively unlocks the next chapter, where events will change and populations of planets will shift a little bit and the spheres of influence will grow or migrate. Mm-hmm. And so that's how we prevented it from all being a shmoo of experience and not feeling like there was a story there. But because you get to make important choices about, do I do these four things in this order? Hey, some of them are required, but a whole bunch of them are optional. So I can kind of either be a completionist and make sure I fulfill all of these before I move on to the next logical section of the game. That balance of structure and freedom is really what gives you the sense that you're telling your own story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think you made a really good point there, Paul, regarding being able to find the fun in the game and giving the player the choices. It's always that very interesting give and take between the intent by the designer or the intent by the game design and having the player basically do their own thing. And that's especially true of games that are built on non-linear or open-ended design, where you basically say to the player, oh, you have all of this to explore, but I want you to do this, 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 and this in that order.
Yeah, we never want the player to ask themselves the question, what does the designer mm-hmm. want me to do?
Yeah, that's making a designer happy is not a fun game. but it's one that some of us do at times. And or guess what the designer's thinking. That's another not fun game mechanic. And also, you know, there's power in linear moments. I mean, some of the more powerful storytelling actually happens when you've got a few seconds of linear storytelling. But once you start doing longer sections of storytelling, you're effectively starting to compete with things like movies and TV shows and for some people, books that have tremendous power in how they tell stories. They don't have any of that interactivity. So finding that balance has really been the magic of making games over the years.
Mm-hmm. And going back to like XCOM, for example, that's another really big example of letting the player define the story. I have seen friends and so many different Let's Plays of people creating these just like sweeping narratives of, you know, nondescript squaddies going on terror missions and all getting wiped out by the Crystallids.
That was one of our favorite games, by the way, mm-hmm. XCOM.
Yeah, the story we told ourselves was that there was a great game mechanic in which different characters with different stats could move at different speeds. And you moved into battle pretty fast, particularly if you're impatient like me. And so inevitably, the fast guys would die because you'd get them into battle if you weren't careful. And the slow guys would survive. And survivors got the experience points and leveled up. So you'd end up with all of these like officers and commanders who were totally losers. And then, you know, the heroes died early. So that was one of our lessons. But no, I think...
What does that say about our lasting this long in the industry, Paul?
We did it by moving slowly. thank goodness. See, you can learn a lot from games.
Yes, yes, you
But I think there is, again, playing with... embracing your players and letting them participate in making the game with you. You have to build some spaces where players can invest themselves. And admittedly, like, if you want to tell a TV show... you've got a really high percentage of the audience who will go along with you. But if you do, say, a radio drama, you're going to have a very small percentage of people because you have to get that audience who's willing to invent the entire visual in their heads. So you need to just make sure that there are those moments where you don't totally describe something. One of our favorite fantasy science fiction authors, Jack Vance, was famous for not describing everything.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of wiggle room, when you basically let the player fill in the blanks or the audience fill in the blanks, can be a very effective form of storytelling. Because it can be very boring to have everything just literally spelled out in black and white for someone.
Yeah, and you wouldn't talk with someone else about the exact identical experience. There's no magic in that. Yeah. You know, the first round of Dungeons & Dragons rules, I think, succeeded because it was so sketchy and so incomplete. And it required the players to actually kind of finish the rule set to even play the game. And so by the time everyone played their first game, they were utterly invested. And it was a personal experience.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know we are hitting about like 40 minutes into the podcast. And again, I could sit here and chat with you guys until the fire. Hopefully it doesn't reach you guys, but there is so much we can easily jump into. I guess one last point regarding kind of like the passive Star Control, and then I definitely want to touch on the Toys to Life genre, at least for a few minutes. Now, for fans of Star Control, I know there's definitely been that touchy subject of Star Control 3 and kind of like how the series kind of died out after that one, at least for a lot of people. I guess for fans listening, I know some will probably ask, what kind of happened with the third game?
We're not sure exactly what you're talking about.
Well, they asked us to do Star Control 3 and they said, we'll give you the same contract we gave you for Star Control 2. But for the last 6 months of that project, we had to self-fund ourselves.
Mm. More to the point, Fred self-funded us.
So that wasn't really appealing. And we were also, at that point, having just spent 2+ years back in the 90s, which was a long time, yeah, on a game. We were kind of ready for a cleansing of the palate.
Mm-hmm.
And so they found a good developer. Legend was, they were good guys. Star Control is the Star Control 2, the Iroquoian Masters. That's a very hard world to play in for someone coming from the outside. It's just there's a certain voice that we speak with, and a certain pace, and a certain sort of balance of irreverence and seriousness and kind of goofiness. And it just was really hard for someone to come in there and innovate and extend it without just not satisfying, being unsatisfying to almost everybody in one way or another. So we felt, I think, sympathy. But on the other hand, you know, it wasn't our game at that point. So we were on to something else. And, you know, those guys, you know, they had to sink or swim on their own.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point about how some of like the most unique games out there basically get their own divining voice. Well, my voice is starting to go out as well right now. XCOM being another really good example of that. Like, there are some very specific elements of that design. The same goes for Star Control, that if you don't hit those points exactly right, you don't have those games anymore. And it can be very hard for someone new coming in to try and essentially run with this idea further.
Yeah, and in all my comments and in Fred's comments, we're speaking for ourselves as our new kind of Dogar and Kazon working on the Ghosts of the Precursors. We're not really speaking for Twice for Bob or Activision. So with XCOM, I think there were a bunch of games in the middle there that people don't remember that well. But boy, when they got back to hitting on what was magical, you know, in the past few years, I mean, I have spent so much time playing the most recent games.
Oh, yes.
But you actually can find that voice if you're lucky or careful or diligent enough. But boy, there are some games it's very hard to do that. Mm-hmm. And I think the Iroquoian Masters is one of them.
Yeah, Ben, I'm also with you there, Paul, regarding the latest XCOMs. I love the two from Firaxis. And I would love to talk to Jake Solomon about that, but I'm sure that's going to be like a 10-hour podcast if I can ever manage to get him on here.
I'd listen.
Go ahead.
Well, I say I'd listen.
Yeah,
we'd
listen to that one.
Nice. Well, if you guys know his phone number, I would love to give him a call and just like start pestering him about it.
What is this phone number you talk about? We don't. I still have landlines, so it's a. But no, good luck with that. Let's see. So did you want to talk a little bit before we run out of time? And hey, you know, we're going to be sort of reappearing from time to time, coming out of our cryotubes to talk with fans and talk with folks like you. So we don't have to get through everything today.
All right. Awesome. Before we move on from Star Control 2, I have a few questions from a few of my friends who are big fans of the game that I asked them if they had any questions for you guys. So, the first one is, did you guys have, like, was the fan reaction to the various factions of Star Control 2, did you expect the fans to either love or hate certain factions, and did they surprise you on that?
Well, I don't know that we expected one or the other exclusively. We tried to make them deep enough so that you might have empathy for every single faction or race.
And also people derived their impressions of the different alien races. For some people, it was the communication pictures or the text or the story. For some people, it was the way the ships behaved. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Greg Johnson and I played Super Melee every day for maybe years. And there was a funny learning curve where all of a sudden it would all be about the Thridash. Someone had figured out something about the Thridash and using its flame, and it just now would tear apart other ships. And I swear they would just rise and fall. So Greg is in love with the Arilu Lalilei, and he wrote a lot of its dialogue, and it's got a lot of his personality in there. And he was so fast with it. His sample rate is so high that he could control it in ways I couldn't. So he could dance around my Urquhart and just drive me utterly bananas. And so that made him really love them. And, you know, I loved Amtrank, who, you know, the Yehat is simple and straightforward. They just blast other people. But the Melnorme, played right is super powerful. And, you know, there were some quirks that just in terms of implementation that we didn't even notice about, like, if you're holding one of the Melnorme's kind of color-changing balls in front of you, it can act as a shield. And so I think we're seeing the world from the inside, having created all the parts and then putting it out there, hoping that that set dressing makes you think there's a reality there. We don't really know what the outside perception is like, because hopefully those folks, we've suspended their disbelief enough that they sort of believe in the totality of it. So maybe in a way it's hard for us to answer that question.
Mm.
Way to dodge, Paul. Thank you. Pivot.
Nice. Another question from a fan. Why does the background change color when you're talking to the Melnorm? Is there a grand mystery? Can you reveal it to the folks listening, or will we get another pivot here?
Facetiously, should we ever have a Kickstarter, that will be one of the very highest level nice. Ways of joining in the investing. You know, we have a lot of theories. I'm not sure if we're going to answer that one or not, but we have been asked that. And I think at a certain point in the testing of our game, because the game actually underwent internal testing for a long, long time, someone started saving up towards that. And really was spending like a lot of their lives. And we're just like, stop. It actually doesn't work. You can't buy it. So, no, but if you are willing to buy us a pizza and beer, maybe we might tell you in person. But we've been living off pizza and beer for years with this exact same trick. So.
Well, unfortunately for the folks listening, I am not next to Paul and Fred right now, so I can't provide them with the pizza and beer requested for that question.
More is the pity.
No.
Stay tuned. Sorry, guys. The bridge turning purple, you'll see. We promise. We swear. No, we don't.
And the last question, I think this kind of goes back to why I asked you earlier regarding your favorite faction, but what faction dialogue was either the most fun or the most difficult for you guys to write for?
We had a lot of help writing. I think initially the Thradash was hard because their initial spec was that they were this race of noble warriors defined by their sort of ethics and their, you know, holding fast to kind of warrior rules. And then I at least found it got boring really fast. And then it was, no, wait, maybe they just think that. But from our outside perspective, they're utterly insane. And then that was great. All of a sudden, they just turned on in my head. And it was really fun to write for them. And I think in a way, possibly the Urquan, the Xerzah, because they were pretty overpowered. They were very powerful. They didn't regard you as being super significant. So they didn't necessarily really want to take the time to talk with you. They mostly just wanted to enslave you or blow you up. And so it was finding a way to give them a reason to talk with you. And that was part of what their back history in the sentient milieu was.
Mm-hmm.
There was a statement that you could make to them that sort of they personally, for their ethics, were required to stop and explain things to you if you asked this one particular question.
Mm-hmm.
So those guys were tough. And then in doing the voice recording, the talking pet was pretty tough because I did that and I used a kind of Beetlejuice voice and we didn't have much time in the studio. So it was just like going through a huge number of lines and I couldn't talk for a long time after that.
Great. I know, I think we will probably put the Toys of Life talk on hold at least for today, because I can basically tell that's going to be a good 40 minute to an hour chat, like it's nothing between the three of us. But yeah,
sure.
If we can do that again in the future, I would definitely love to have you guys back on, because that is a very fascinating topic. And I have Skylanders and Amiibos pretty much like all around me here, like right, like one of like those old like Twilight Zone episodes when the dolls come to life or something to come and get me.
Well, yeah, the Toys to Life. I actually have like two IKEA lit cabinets in my bedroom.
Nice,
and they're full of Skylanders, and you know. Every new Skylanders, I need kind of a new cabinet, and my wife has pretty much laid down the law that the bedroom cannot have another 100 Skylanders in it. So I started decorating the tops of all of our bookcases. We're both book freaks, you know, thousands of books. So now there are Skylanders. Many of them are the glow-in-the-dark ones.
Nice.
So when you turn off the lights, the room just glows with glow-in-the-dark Skylanders, which I find really cool. And she is patient with me. Thank you, Lori. Thank you very much.
Yes. All right. So I think with that, we'll spend the remainder of our time kind of talking about what you guys are working on now. And that is, of course, going to be Ghosts of the Precursors. So it, obviously for fans listening, it has been a very long time since we've had a new Star Control game. What was kind of the inspiration or the reason to start working on it today?
Well, there's a couple, three, four, maybe. one is it's the 25th anniversary. And two, we are at a point in our relationship with Activision where we do have some time to spend outside of our normal duties, working on it. And three, we're not getting any younger.
And I think the idea that, you know, Fred and I have had this really great experience. We founded Toys for Bob almost 28 years ago, and we've been leading it since it was just the two of us up through, at times, you know, almost 150 people here, and, you know, creating Skylanders together with the whole team of 150 plus made one of the most successful IPs of all time. So that's great. We did that. And though as any executive in the world, I presume, and certainly as a studio head, your job is not to actually make the content of the game. Your job is to empower others to do that and to find new talent and to communicate with the kind of the other divisions within your company. You know, make sure marketing has everything that they need. Make sure that the executives have what the current state of the game is. And you're part of a very large, fun, powerful organism. But you're not drawing pixels on the screen. You're not going into the recording booth and making crazy sounds. And that is just important to who we are. And, you know, for Fred, he's the engineering side of this, and he's, of course, reads science fiction at least as much as I do, so he's very involved in the stories and characters. But we want to actually do some direct craftsmanship work.
And we also miss being clever. When you have a large studio backed by a super large publisher, there's a sledgehammer of money that is always available to you. And
not an unlimited amount,
but it's thrilling to sort of be on the seat of your pants again.
And that's entirely true. And that sledgehammer that we have friends who have a studio by that name, you really have to find different problems to solve. The tools that you have sometimes dictate the problems that you're going to seek out. So if you have a staff of 150 really talented people, making a text-based roguelike game is really not going to work. And if what you want to do is actually go into a quiet room for 3 weeks and write an alien race's dialogue, that's not going to work either. So you have to sort of set yourself up to have the tools and the resources available to do the project that you want to do. And I think one of the reasons why we don't want to walk into making Ghosts of the Precursors with, you know, a huge, huge amount of money is we would immediately have to step back from it and start organizing and empowering others and being responsible with the budget that we had. And it's just exactly what Fred said, being sort of everything by the seat of our pants initially and having to seek out the talent of others, we're reaching out to most of the people who helped us initially to see if they actually want, 25 years later, want to help us again. And definitely some of them are going to, and we'll be talking more about that as the months go on. But, I can tell you it's kind of giddy fun. And it's terrifying at the same time. But it's got us, waking up, I think, and running into work. Even faster than before.
Awesome. And again, as I said at the beginning, it's still very early in terms of Ghosts of the Precursors, in terms of development. So I know we can't exactly talk about exactly what you guys are working on for the next... I guess, do you guys have an idea of how long you're going to spend working on the game?
You know, we're not going to, unfortunately, get into that. But what we can say is we've spent 25 years talking about it, and I have notebooks full of ideas ranging from 1994 up until last year. So we have material that's driving what we're doing, mm-hmm. and a lot of – we also set out to – So who is the game for is one of the first questions you need to ask when you're making a game.
Yes.
It's really important to understand, are you making it purely for yourself? Do you have an audience in mind? Are you just making it and hoping an audience finds it? We're making this for the people who enjoyed Star Control 1 and Star Control 2. That's who we're making it for. And the Urquan Masters, probably more people have played the open source Urquan Masters than played any of the disc-based or downloaded versions that we created in the 80s and 90s. So we're not looking to redefine the audience, because I think we would have to entirely redefine the game to do that, and that isn't what we want to do. So I think what we're committing to is, if you liked Star Control 2, it's highly likely you'll enjoy this game. That said, you immediately run into, gee, things have changed a little bit since 1992. And how much of modern times do you want to embrace? You know, we've transitioned from, you know, teletype games to, you know, card-based, very, you know, 16-color games to now, you know, everything's fully 3D and sometimes photorealistic or highly stylized. You can pretty much do whatever you can visualize. But there's decisions you make about things like graphics that then limit stylistically what you can achieve. You know, it's relatively hard in 3D, for example, to create some effects which painters can paint in 2D with no problem. Mm-hmm. And so those are, I think, months from now, talking about how we've addressed those questions will be really a fun conversation.
And beyond just the aesthetic looks, you can't really do the same melee in 3D as you can in 2D, because the 2D just has such perfect, you have such perfect information about where your ship is, what it's doing. You don't fire a shot and see it disappear into the distance and have a report of it hitting a ship somewhere far away.
And in what ways, what are the ways that sort of build passion and excitement without requiring people to think about things differently?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so one of the things we've talked about is there's a desire to say, okay, we had 16 alien races in the first game. We're going to come up with 16 brand new ones, and they're going to have a whole new story. And then we started thinking, well, what if I was watching a new Star Trek and, like, there was no character I'd ever heard of before, and the ship looked entirely different, and all the aliens were different, and I that wouldn't interest me that much. So one of the things we're realizing, there's a balance between what's old and what's new, and we need to make sure that we've got enough new to tell a whole new story meaningfully and to have some surprises and some cool new powers and ships. But on the other hand, we do need to meaningfully go back and continue to tell the story of a lot of the aliens that were around back then. Not all of them, because there's just, you can't fill up your narrative so full and make any meaningful progress if you have, you know, 400 characters to kind of drag around through it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, on a narrative sense, that's one of the most fun and challenging things, is how do you take characters for whom in many ways you resolved and then make them go forward? And we kind of, I don't know if we were just joking or clever back in 1992, but in the end, we sort of carved out, you know, that it turns out that the whole game you're playing is the retelling of someone in their old age, far older than we are now, to their grandkids about this thing that happened in the past. And then he hints about other events that occurred, but we don't have time to talk about those now. So that provides us with one potential way to look at the framing. And, you know, I think if you remember the end of Star Control, you know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to spoil it too much. But so there's some expectations between in the fans have, and, you know, we have to decide how we're going to satisfy those. And then we have to surprise people.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, have them run into something they totally didn't expect, but fits into that world perfectly.
Yeah. And I'm not sure if you guys can answer this question now, but like talking about things from a gameplay perspective, as we've said over the last hour, Star Control and Star Control 2 had that very unique voice in terms of game design with the exploration, Super Melee, and the adventure style. And obviously, as we've said, things have certainly changed in terms of game design philosophy over the last two decades. And we brought up XCOM and how with Firaxis, they kind of took that original design and ran with it with their own voice. With Ghosts of the Precursors, do you guys feel like you're going to stick pretty much adhering to the original core game design? Or do you think you'll try and modernize it in some aspects, again, given how much game design has changed over the last 20 years?
You know, you'll definitely recognize this if you played Star Control 2. You'll think that this is a sequel to that game. Mm-hmm. Ghost of the Precursors will be an obvious sequel. And I think the distinction between Star Control 1 and Star Control 2, we won't be as strong of a distinction in terms of the fundamental mechanics. Star Control 3 introduced some base building and colonization. Mm-hmm. And we don't necessarily know that that's the story we want to tell. In terms of entirely different modes, that's one, you know, what we want to do is start by modernizing isn't the right way. Making current, making believable and sensible in the modern times. The key parts, spaceship combat is I'm pretty sure where we start. We want to make sure that that works for the people who loved our game. They feel like it's developed, that it's still the same fun, but it's richer and it's got some innovation. So my guess is telling stories the way we did in Star Control 2, there may be differences in the interface, but ultimately I think a lot of it's going to come through conversation with aliens, because that's just so much fun. And then systems built on top of that, it's sort of hard to get into those. I wouldn't want to talk about them before showing them mm-hmm. to people, and we're not ready to show them to people, because in general, things that are fun to play, people that should play them before they talk about them.
All right.
And ultimately, real quick, if I can say that, you know, we are a product of our times. So while we have tracked through technology and developments, we aren't learning game design now. So I think that people coming into this industry would probably make Ghosts of the Precursors differently than we would. Not right or wrong, but it's just sort of the vocabulary in their own gaming experience is going to be dramatically different. Mm-hmm. We're not necessarily seeing this as a kind of a mobile MTX-based monetizing experience. One of the great flexibilities we have, actually, is initially we aren't thinking about money at all. That's another reason why we're sort of keeping it a small outfit initially, is we don't want to make any of the key design narrative decisions revolving around money. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if we're working for somebody else, we have to do that. That's part of being a responsible employee, but we can be totally irresponsible with our own company. You don't have to quote me on that.
And I guess with that said, Paul, are you guys playing, I know we joked about this a few minutes ago, but do you guys think you will go to Kickstarter or some kind of crowdfunding platform for Ghosts of the Precursors, or is it too soon to tell right now?
I think it's way too soon to tell. It ultimately depends on how much work is necessary and how much we can get done with either volunteers or through our own work. One of the great things about Star Control 2, the Urquhart Masters, was we brought in talent that had never worked on games before. And the music, we can talk about the whole crazy thing we did with music. But if there's a way that we can embrace people who want to participate in games but haven't before, you know, we're not going to be in a position to field a million inquiries right now. I'll just get that out there. But we found fresh energy, fresh takes on all different kinds of things by kind of coming at it sideways and bringing in people. Like, we had some of the greatest artists in modern history writing dialogue for us. And, you know, we had some great writers doing art for us, and we had some, it turns out, young teenagers writing music for us. And it was coherent, and it worked. And it was just a matter, I think, opening the door up a little bit and being somewhat, having some discretion about who's doing what. But we would love if we could refine that magic as well.
Mm-hmm. All right. I know, again, we have gone over our hour, and I could sit here and chat with you guys all day long if we had the time. I guess to begin to wrap things up, at least for today, one question that someone, one of my friends said, I don't know if they were joking or not, but this is just too good not to ask you guys. But I guess sort of ties back to Toys to Life for a second. Do you guys think we'll ever see Toys to Life models of the various ships from Star Control in the future?
You know, who knows what the future holds? There's folks, not us, working on games that combine science fiction spaceships and Toys to Life, and probably watch how they do it first to see how successful it is. But that may well be out of scope for what we can do. Like, when we get to the Toys to Life conversation, one of the things I'll say is we couldn't have done Skylanders without Activision as a partner in any, many ways. And one of them is because making toys is like D-Day.
Yes.
There are literally thousands of people who have to work hard to make it happen. And you don't do that with two guys. You don't do that with 50 guys. And you need people who've made toys, made electronics, made things overseas, shipped things from overseas. And the success of what we've done was based on having all of those talents, which we don't have, and which require the capacity to invest dramatically so that you can then see even more dramatic rewards. And I think we would be hesitant about tackling that on our own.
Mm-hmm. All right, so for the folks listening, I think at this point we're not going to be hunting down the Illrath ships anytime soon at Toys R Us or Target, sadly.
No, they're a Best Buy exclusive.
Nice. And glow in the dark, too. Don't forget that.
Yeah. Hey, there's 3D printing. You know, people, if they want to make ships one of the things that we, in the open source version is – we've been pretty open with people playing with the world as long as they aren't just earning money at it. And so people out there have actually made 3D models of some of the spaceships, and there's ways to 3D print them. And there's some amazing Lego models and rules for building all of the spaceships. So there are ways to get some of those toys, at least in non-to-life form right now.
Great.
Well, if you have a good imagination, I suppose.
One final question regarding Ghost of the Precursors. Is there anything that we didn't touch on regarding either the design or the inspiration or anything like that that you guys would like to mention now?
I don't think so. We're going to save our powder for a little ways down the road. So I would say that our sample rate will be better than once every 3 years. Just be persistent.
Yeah, there'll be a sequel, Ghosts of Paul and Fred.
But I think we didn't have that much to talk about with Ghosts of the Precursors yet. And, you know, frankly, this is this period of time where we can talk about the 25th anniversary and how, I guess we didn't say this, but we've had tremendous success in our careers at several different times. But Star Control was unique. The Urquhart Masters was unique in how many people have come to us and talked about it either, you know, inspiring them or getting them through a hard time in their life or, you know, teaching them the importance of paying attention to how many earthquakes there are on the surface of the planet. and it means something to us personally and emotionally to work on. So I think that's a large part of what's driving our return to doing this now.
Great. I guess with that, do you have any, I guess, things you would like to say to the fans, I guess, in honor of the 25th anniversary?
We'd like to say to our fans, first of all, thank you for playing Star Control 2, the Urquhart Masters, because without that, we wouldn't have jobs. And to those people who bought it, thank you. For those people who pirated it, if you ever run into us, buy us a pizza. but ultimately, you know, it's their imaginations, the players' imaginations, that willingness to sort of step outside of real life and join us in kind of that world of Viroquan and all our alien friends. That makes us kind of a family or a tribe, and we just love knowing that there's people out there who are as weird and creative and fun as we hope we are.
Awesome. And again, for those of you listening, we could spend who knows how many more hours talking. And again, hopefully in less than 2 years, we definitely need to have that talk about Toys to Life genre, because I'm definitely fascinated about it. And I'm sure that'll be another very lengthy podcast right there.
Yeah. And, you know, there might even, we represent just the tip of the iceberg of people who've been brilliant and worked incredibly hard on that. And I think that there are, you know, folks here at Toys for Bob, if this conversation could be framed more as a Toys for Bob conversation, yeah, we potentially talk with people who worked in a lot of different aspects of that. That would be interesting.
Yep, definitely. All right. So at the risk of going into like hours 2 through 5, I think it's time to wrap things up for today. Again, Paul, Fred, has been an absolute pleasure hanging out with you today. The best of luck with Ghost of the Precursors. And I definitely want to talk to you guys again in the, again, coming months or years. And I don't know if I'll be able to give you guys pizza and beer, but we'll see what happens.
It'll work wonders. But thank you very much.
Yes, yeah, send that email now.
Yeah, send now. And maybe in the next year and a half, we'll get things scheduled.
All right. Talk to you later.
All right. So with all that said, we're going to wrap things up for today's podcast. Again, there is a lot more we can talk about, but we will have to save that for another time. So definitely keep an eye out for Ghosts of the Precursors. I guess at this point, coming eventually. We don't have an exact time just yet, but I'm sure myself and a lot of people are going to be hopefully waiting at our keyboards for it.
Great.
So for those of you listening, thank you so much for tuning in. As always, if you'd like to support Game Wisdom, there are several options available. You can follow me on Twitter at GWBicer for updates throughout the day. You can check out my YouTube channel, where I talk about game design topics, have live discussions with developers, and of course, spotlight games. And be sure to check me out on Patreon under patreon.com/GWBicer for ways to support the site and allow me to grow things with more content and get you guys access to some nifty rewards. I guess before we go, do you guys have any websites or Twitter or Facebook pages you like to promote for Ghosts of the Precursors or Toys for Bob?
Well, I think we're speaking for ourselves, so we'll say ghostsoftheprecursors.com is a place you can go. Dogarandkazon.com is also a place you can go. We are Dogar and Kazon in Twitter. We are novices at this world of social media, so bear with us if we do something horribly embarrassing. But so far, it's been great in being able to get into contact with fans and friends that we haven't talked with in ages.
All right. Sounds great. So with that said, thanks again for tuning to this week's Perceptive Podcast. Have a great rest of the week, and I will talk to you guys again next time. Take care. All right. And...